here comes the colonel, here comes the colonel, here comes the colonel.
Yeah, well, at least it seems somebody is happy about it. I wonder, who was that? Who was that lady anyway? That was no lady. That was right. Well, welcome back. The second half of The Promise of Tomorrow on the Science News Radio Network. I'm your host. I'm Curtal Mason. We're going to get back to our interview in just a minute with Nigel Snowd. He's the product manager for Google Crisis Response and Civic Innovations. So at a time of crisis, Google can be extremely important. And we had wondered how people, when their house is falling down around them and tornadoes have ripped through, how they know about this great crisis stuff from Google. So Nigel is a keynote speaker of the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on at the San Jose Garden Hotel Airport in California in Silicon Valley, October 20th through the 23rd. You'll want to be sure and attend that conference. You can find out more information about that at our website at promiseoftomorrow.biz on the right-hand side of your screen. Right now, let's step over to our fountain of useless information. Rummage around here in the coin jar and pull today's query.
Welcome to the fountain of useless information. How can I help you?
I hear him. Here he is, up from the depths. The spirit of the fountain knows we threw in the coins. The spirit who knows all, hears all, sees all, and tells all for a price. All right. Oh, spirit of the fountain, we have asked you one time before in our great series of questions of who was buried in Grant's tomb. We asked you, how long did the Hundred Years' War last? Of course, we know the Hundred Years' War lasted 116 years from 1337 to 1453. So now, today's query, oh, spirit of the fountain, how long did the 30 Years' War last? The 30 Years' War, how long did it last?
I have given you my answer, and now you may tell the others.
The spirit of the fountain knows all, hears all, sees all, and does tell all for a price. Can't fool the old spirit of the fountain. The 30 Years' War lasted 30 years, of course, from 1618 to 1648. All right, can't fool the spirit of the fountain, so let's get back to our exciting interview today with Google's Nigel Snowd. Ah, yes, the Science News Studio Band, taking us back to our interview with Nigel Snowd, Google Crisis Response and Civic Innovation. When we left at the half hour, we had asked him, how do people find out all the good things that Google can do for them at time of a crisis?
Well, so a couple of things. I mean, I've spent sort of more than the past decade of my life working on major emergencies, humanitarian conflict and natural disasters worldwide for the UN and elsewise. And, you know, the chaos is just a part of having a complex situation. It's always going to exist. People are always scrambling and trying to figure out how to get done. And that said, though, you operate within structures of how you coordinate and communicate. And I have to say we have a great relationship with FEMA and the Red Cross and others, whereby sometimes it's as loose as telling everybody what we've done, and sometimes we have formal meetings and figure out how to share information and so forth. And it really does depend on the circumstance. But you're right on touching that preparedness is a really important part of it, is that setting things up ahead of time so that there is data, there are licenses, and really this is a big open data story in the sense that we talk about it with government data, as President Obama recently signed a bunch of executive orders, I think. And so what you want is you want data to be open and licensed for reuse so that it can really get to, so we can be a channel for this authoritative and useful information to get to citizens in a really sort of strong and structured and active way.
Yeah.
And you did say, how do people find access to this? I mean, one of the critical things we know and the reason we're involved in this is that people come to Google to look for information. And that is certainly true during a crisis. And we see significant spikes in our search traffic, people looking for information about tsunamis, for instance, after there's been an earthquake in one part of the world in the Pacific Ocean, and so forth. So one of the things we want to do is to have the information on hand to give them a really good answer to that, that helps them understand what they need to do to keep themselves safe. And it's great working at Google. It's one of the reasons I came to Google to do this, is that we have the infrastructure and the reach to be able to do that and answer those questions really well and help people. And a really, I suppose, a big underlying theme of that as well is that during an emergency, people use the tools that they use every day. People come to search and to Google to find information. People use spreadsheets rather than complex project management systems because that's what they use every day. And so it's really important for authorities and everybody to recognize this. And I think they're doing a pretty good job sort of coming to terms with it, but then figuring out what to do is another matter. But how do you use these channels? And this is why TV is so exceptional and radio particularly and so forth. But it's changing. People are increasingly looking to the internet for information. So we also do a lot of outreach with news services, and we make sure that almost all of our tools around mapping, so a map of the shelter zones and the crisis maps and so forth, as we call them, and missing persons information and alerts and all kinds of other things are actually embeddable and available through news sites, and third parties can pick them up, and even people can create their own is our ultimate goal.
Well, people creating their own, and that leads me to the next question always, and sorry for me to, but I get to ask every dumb question, you know, on the program. I'm the dumbest one here. Every guest and every listener knows a whole lot more than me. No, the dumb question is this, what about somebody feeding you erroneous information in order to divert attention so that they can do mischief someplace else, like could happen in a Homeland Security situation, or, I don't know, a bank robbery, or a situation like the Boston bombing, or that sort of thing. How do you filter the information?
So there's a couple of different answers to that. So one of which is that we make sure that where we have authoritative information, that that's our first source, and that we also sort of make it very clear to both validate and have secure channels, and then also sort of make sure that citizens know who's the source and who's the authority. So there's a bunch of research on what it takes to understand and trust and make decisions on it, public warnings and alerts, for instance. So there's some really great stuff there, including in social media. So one, authoritative information clearly communicated, and where a channel for that is really critically important. So our public alerting product does that, for instance, and if we've got a layer of data from FEMA about flood zones or evacuation zones from New York City and so forth, that's really clear as well. So that's one piece about it. But what you're kind of talking about, I think, is about more about crowdsourcing and user-generated content, whether it's from Twitter or a project like Ushahidi, where people put points on a map.
And yeah.
Am I correct?
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, that's where I'm going with this.
Yeah. So there's a couple of observations, one of which is that the public's actually a little bit smarter and more credulous than we often give them credit for, in terms of being able to do the correlation and identify what's obviously abusive and not. So that's one piece. The second, I mean, I guess at top level, the fact is that if you're providing a crowdsourced solution, you can't validate and verify absolutely everything, which is why we're very cautious about crowdsourced information. It's really important information, but, you know, you shouldn't trust everything you read on Twitter as being absolute truth.
No, of course not.
With any service that has any range of inputs. So there's actually providing it in context so people can make their own minds and decisions, and so you're clear about what's authoritative and what's not, as I said.
Okay.
But there's a couple of things that we have observed, which is that in the first couple of years, and we're still in early days, frankly, if I measure about years, of having this rapid crowd information, which is, let me be frank, the best information out there in many cases, that one, the good stuff tends to drown out the bad. If you have enough people around, the validation happens very quickly and the error correction happens very quickly. And there's been a numerous examples about this, so we're more worried about sort of the rumors being driven and so forth. But we've also seen that error correction and rumor correction tends to travel faster than the bad information as well.
Oh, really?
It's interesting.
Wow.
So, and this is not some of my observations. There's a pile of research on this from very good social science researchers through to people like the Red Cross wondering and being careful about how social media is used, and, of course, programs funded by FEMA and others that I've sort of watched from afar and sometimes sat on committees of.
Mm-hmm.
So, look, there's never but public situations, and that sort of it's just a hard problem. I think there's at least five. I shouldn't say a direct number. I know of a number of EU finance programs, for instance, with large amounts of research dollars trying to tackle some of these exact questions.
Yeah. All right.
What you're saying, what you're wanting.
Absolutely. That's getting somewhere towards what I'm looking for. Now, you're going to be the keynote speaker at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference in San Jose, and you're going to kind of fill everybody in on some of these things that you and I are talking about. Is there one big takeaway you want people to really impress people with at that conference, so when they leave the conference, you want to really embed a central idea in their mind? And if you do, can you give us kind of a preview?
Yeah, I mean, I'd say the big idea is one of the ones I've already touched on right now, which is that people go during a crisis to the places they and trust the sources they use every day. They use the tools every day, and they go to the sources they use every day. So for anyone who has crisis information, authoritative and otherwise, that the activities of people like Google and others is actually really important as a channel and information source. And there's things that information providers, official and otherwise, need to be doing to make that more useful. Right? Open data, good licenses, so forth. But the other message that I think is really important is that the change that we're seeing in the world of sort of consumer applications and consumer data and services and the ability of people to make mashups of information in their neighborhoods and so forth is happening in the crisis space very particularly. Right? I mean, the simplest example is the very first Google mashup was a crime map, which said, where are safe neighborhoods around me? And it spawned a whole industry of mashups that Google happily participates in. And so you look at that, and what you're seeing is that citizens are being empowered with the information so that they can look after themselves and protect their families and their neighborhoods and work with each other. So the more that we can do to enable citizens to work together to understand what's happening around them and to sort of communicate with and listen to authorities, the better off they're going to be and the stronger our communities and neighborhoods are going to be. And that's what resilience really means. And it's going to be through the everyday tools. It's going to be through the Twitters. It's going to be through the Google search. It's going to be through all the things that we want to provide them and that open data and smart search like we're trying to do can empower. So you have to look at that and say that's actually an awesome thing, because the kinds of response capabilities that we have from a local fire department and police department in the U.S. are not going to be what's going to be available in Indonesia everywhere. And so you have to find ways that citizens can communicate and share and react and help themselves. There's an old stat from the Red Cross that I like, which is the fact that something like worldwide, sort of 90% or 95% of all disaster and crisis responses happen from your neighborhood and family and communities. It's not outsiders coming in to help. It's actually local. So the more tools that go to those locals, the better off everybody is going to be.
All right. Fascinating stuff. Now, I know you and your colleagues at Google spent a good deal of time looking into the future and trying to figure out where things are going to be the most useful. Why don't you put on the meditation cap for just a minute and settle back, kind of close your eyes, look down the road, and tell us what you all see as far as the future, maybe 5 years, 10 years, or longer down the road. Do you have a prediction for us?
Look, I think no one's got a good answer about what the future is really going to bring in any of these spaces. But I think I mentioned one of them, which is that trend to citizens being able to stand up and organize their own responses and be self-organized is definitely going to be the future of a lot of this. That authority is going to emerge from those who do, right? And who inform and act as the social hubs in their communities and provide the information and validate information. So I think you'll see a whole pile of tools built around that and on top of social networking services and information services that really enable that, and the authorities have to figure out how they work with that and empower it. Is it a neighborhood watch scenario? Is it a AmeriCorps, Citizen Corps scenario? Or is it something different? I don't quite know how it's going to play out, but that's definitely where things are going to go. And one of the other consequences that really relates to that is going to be how... I'm going to make three prognostications, so that's one.
Okay.
The second is that the trend that Google's been on and others are on, which is about the fact that we will sort of ambiently provide you with the information you need to know, so the digital assistants, if you like. So if you look at Google Now as a great example on Android, as sort of it pops up and just usefully hints at the things you need to know. And we make use of all the information we have in our data services and our search engines and so forth to show that to you so that it's useful and relevant when and where and in context that it matters. And that kind of information for crisis has to extend over to crisis situations and other kinds of civic services. And that's going to be fantastic for you, right? And the third thing that is actually a little bit of a divergent difference, which is the impact of modeling and big data and availability is going to make a big difference here too. I mean, the obvious things, I think, are, you know, forecasting and doing better weather forecasts and predictions. There's some great things there, for instance, in Moore, Oklahoma, the tornadoes, the forecast models are going to get better, and there's some exciting things very near to launch there for the National Weather Service, I believe. But I'm talking partly about things like disaster risk reduction. So the kind of catastrophe modeling, the longer-term planning, for instance, no one makes an infrastructure investment decision, a bridge, a road, a school in the US without their insurers or their communities or the city or the government making use of a very sophisticated set of data modeling services around big data, population data, weather and risk profiles, flood histories, and all kinds of catastrophe modeling based on building profiles and probabilities and so forth. Right? And it helps people make really good and better and safer decisions about how strong to build a building and where to put it, for instance. That's just not available for most of the world. I think there's going to be an amazing trend to make those kind of data and services available all over the place, which will really change how cities are built and how communities make their decisions and how donors make the decisions about investments. And hopefully, it might not be in a year, it might not be in 3 years, but you look further down the line, that those kind of smart urban development decisions are hopefully going to be much more data-driven and keep people a lot safer.
Wow, what a great, comforting peek of the future. I'd like to get us down to Main Street here for just a minute. And with a friend of mine, that we'll call her Lori. She's an eighth grade science teacher on the edge of civilization in Texas. And she's got a couple of daughters who are going to college in Austin, Texas. And she went to pick one up to go out of town on a trip recently. She was explaining this to me. She said, I asked Amber, she said, what's the quickest way, the easiest way to get out of town? And Amber replied, that's not a question for a human being. And she got out her cell phone and she started to manipulate and she found the best route out of town. Well, my friend Lori, the eighth grade school teacher who teaches eighth grade on the edge of civilization, was incensed. She says, that isn't what I wanted to know. I wanted to know what you thought was the best way of getting out of town. I didn't expect that kind of an answer. And how are our kids going to get along in a world where they're so dependent on technology? I mean, they're absolutely tied to technology. How are they going to get along? So she asked me that question. I said, well, I'm going to talk to Nigel Snowd one of these days. And I said, when I do, I'm going to ask him how he would answer that.
Well, they want to take away your calculators and telephones as well. I mean, let's be real about this, and this is where we're at. We make use of tools because they enhance our capabilities, right? They let us be safer and lead more productive and satisfying lives. Also, many tools have pathological things in terms of how they affect what we do as well, right? They're just tools. They're who we are and how we use them. So the question is not about the technology. The question back to her as a parent, a mother, a teacher, myself as a parent looking at my daughter playing with an iPad, right, is what am I teaching her about her ability to think and to learn? And so, you know, can a kid do addition without a calculator? I hope so, but is it the way most people are going to be doing addition through the rest of their lives? Not really. So what are the skills they need to learn to be successful and productive citizens is how I'd phrase it. And it may be that the skills of yesterday, the skills of yesterday almost never the skills of tomorrow, right? So she's right, I think, by the sounds of it, to focus on the learning skills about the knowledge that she's trying to get kids to understand. That's what I'd like for my kids, that's for sure. So I didn't want to be flippant about saying calculators and telephones as opposed to learning the way out of town, etc. But if you come to disasters specifically and preparedness and everything else, the US government, so FEMA and the Red Cross have been really right on the money for some of this. There's other things I might disagree on, but just that there's no substitute for having a discussion around a kitchen table about where are we going to go and how we're going to meet up when we get out of... if a tornado comes or a hurricane comes to the US or so forth, and do we have the things, do we know what to do to keep ourselves safe, right? And that can be helped by technology, but it doesn't change the fact that people being aware and having the conversation. I think that's true for so many other parts that where we look at technology as an enabler or as a crutch or as an impediment to having the real thinking. But yeah, ultimately we've got to actually grasp the fact that we have to learn and teach, and technology is just a tool.
All right. One more thing. I know Kate would like to see us get out of here in some decent time. Can you give us something for the voice of reason? Maybe a lesson that you learned late in life that you wish you would have learned a little sooner, and something you might pass on to other people as a word of wisdom?
To a broad audience. I mean, I've been extremely lucky to be able to follow some of my passions by working for Google on crisis response and civic innovation and sort of working on, to some extent, our elections programs and other things. And my voice of reason is actually that we've often got really good intuition about the things that need to get done. And being able to find a place, I'm really lucky and fortunate to be able to do it, to find a place where I can chase up some of those intuitions about the fact that we need to empower people with information, that it's about citizens, not necessarily about institutions or about authorities and so forth, is actually really sort of my intuition here. And I think the piece that has come with me is that it's about how do we get citizens and individuals to the tools and information so they can act and make good decisions. And my thread of work from my previous careers in the field doing disasters, emergencies, through to what we're doing at Google now, is really about sort of following on from that one insight. So I think I'm pretty lucky to have been able to chase it, but it's also been a very clear choice that I've made. And I look at a bunch of other people trying to chase the same things, and I'm really excited by that. So that's the wish I'd have for an insight, a wish for others, is to find a similar sort of piece of insight. And this is a really good one, because I think it really matters for all of our communities. And everybody working on it is only going to make things better.
All right, Nigel Snowd, the product manager for Google Crisis Response and Civic Innovation. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks a lot.
And at this time, I want to thank you very much for those of you who have contributed to this program. We depend on contributions from listeners like you for the existence of this show. We're totally science community supported. So those of you who have contributed, thank you very much. Those of you who wish to can do so at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. On the right-hand side of your screen, you'll see a little tab there for donations. Just click the donations, and we appreciate all your help.
And now we make time for the voice of reason. Listener comments, ideas, and suggestions.
That you chase success, and you say, yes, as soon as I'm successful, then I'll be happy. And so I'll work hard now, I'll become successful, and then I'll be happy. And the problem with that, as soon as you reach success, you move the goalpost, you know, because you're successful and you say, oh, now I want to be even more successful. But a lot of times, if you keep moving the goalpost and saying, you know, I'll get successful and then I'll be happy, so I'll just work hard now, you sort of sacrifice your short-term happiness. But if you can kind of flip that on its head and say, I'm going to take steps to be happy now, then that means I can work harder and work more efficiently and become successful. So success becomes the goal, not happiness becoming the goal. Happiness is the way that you get there. And there's actually been studies that prove that you can actually do that. You can train yourself to be happier and more positive, and that it actually does make you more efficient and more likely to succeed. And, you know, every time you open your email, open your inbox, just send a positive email to somebody. You know, I mean, it can be one of the ones you were going to send anyway, but it could be just send an email to a friend and just make it positive. Or every day, look back and write down or just tell a friend about one positive experience. So just think of, in the last 24 hours, what's one positive thing that's happened? And last but not least, just for 30 minutes a day, just turn off your phone, turn off your computer, and just relax. And just take it easy. You know, try to unplug. And that can really sort of help you focus. So just my life lesson that I've learned is that you can, if you really focus on how good things are going now, or even just if things aren't going so well, just the small little positive things, you can train yourself to be happier with what you have, and that will make you more efficient and make you more successful. Sure. My name is Joel Spark, and I'm an aerospace engineer from Canada.
So you decide, has this really been the voice of reason? Listener comments are welcome at 214-329-4949. And please tell us your name and where you're from.
You've been listening to The Promise of Tomorrow with Colonel Mason, the definitive program on emerging and nanotechnologies, now archived and streamed on the web at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Join us next week at the same time as we learn more about the promise of tomorrow.
I am waiting for you.